I want to report here on a very simple model based on the thin flux tube approximation in order to explain one of the most outstanding features of bipolar active regions. And this is related to the well-known asymmetry. When we get an image from an active region, we apply the most advanced techniques for imaging processing, we get how an active region looks like in reality. This is a real active region, it's not a cartoon. And among the properties that are typical for these bipolar active regions, we have that there is a tilt angle of the active region's main axis, which is by typically 10 degrees with respect to the equator. We also know that F spots, the follower spot, lay closer to the lines of neutral polarity than the P spot, the preceding spot. I think this was pointed out for the first time by Christoph and Lydia van Driel. And also that P spots in general are more stable than F spots in the sense that they are less fragmented than F spots. And it has been claimed, I think, first by van Driel and Petrovai, and then by Wang and Shili, that these three properties, I'm not including the fourth one about the tilt angle, that these three properties are probably the manifestation of one single feature. And this feature is a geometrical asymmetry of the flux tube prior to emergence. So if this is the photosphere and we assume that the active region is going to appear through the emergence of this flux tube through the photosphere, and this is going to be the F spot, and the intersection of this wing with the photosphere will be the P spot, then some authors have claimed that if the tube has prior to eruption a shape like this, in which the F spot has a magnetic field that is more vertical than the P spot, then we get these three properties explained. Now the question is, what is the physical cause of this geometrical asymmetry? And I think that in the literature, two different kinds of explanation have been put forward. The first was that this difference in inclination between the P and the F parts is due to a local phenomenon near the surface. It happens below the surface. And I have given here some references, probably there are more, of papers where this problem has been dealt with. But another way of approaching this problem is to interpret this difference in inclination as a result from the magnetic flux evolution from the very bottom of the convection zone up to the surface. And this was first published by Moreno Incertis et al. In a letter in Solar Physics. What they did was to integrate the set of MHD equations using the thin flux tube approximation for curved tubes, starting for a toroidal flux tube that is in equilibrium at the base of the convection zone or below. I do not want to go very much into details of the thin flux tube approximation. I will just mention some very general things. When we use the thin flux tube approximation for studying the evolution, the dynamics of magnetic flux tubes in the convection zone, what we are doing practically is to consider the motion of a 1D continuum, that is the flux tube, in a 3D Euclidean space. In our case, it is the rotating star. And the starting point is the equation of motion that I'm writing here, assuming we are working in a non-inertial frame of reference, whereby omega is the rotation velocity of this non-inertial frame. Then this equation of motion is projected on the Frenet basis made up of a tangent, normal, and binormal vectors along each point of the axis of the flux tube. this equation of motion, of course, must be complemented with an equation of continuity, the equation of induction, an equation of energy, and the equation of energy that was used by Moreno and Certis-Tal, and the one that I'm going to use for my linear approach to this problem is the equation, the assumption of isentropic evolution, in the sense that the time scales involved in this problem are much shorter than the time scales needed for establishing thermal equilibrium. I will call S the arc length along the flux tube at a time t, but it's also important to use the arc length S0, which is the arc length along the equilibrium path, and this can be used as a Lagrangian coordinate. In what I'm going to tell you next, it's very important to make an appropriate choice between the Eulerian description and the Lagrangian description. Indeed, in order to show analytically how this asymmetry results, you have to resort to both descriptions, the Eulerian and the Lagrangian, and at a given time you have to change from one to the other. And I think that the choice of the appropriate Lagrangian coordinate can simplify calculations very much. So this is the Lagrangian coordinate that I'm using, the path length at time t equals 0. The flux tube is originally somewhere in the convection zone or below. For what I'm going to tell you, it does not make any difference whether we assume the flux tubes are stored in the overshoot layer or they are stored in the convection zone. You just need the flux tube is originally in equilibrium. It is sitting somewhere. And the non-inertial frame I'm going to choose is a non-inertial frame rotating with the matter inside the flux tube when it is in equilibrium. Since it is toroidal, it is axisymmetric, then this is given simply by constant scalar. And the matter outside the flux tube, that's to say the stellar matter, rotates with differentially. I'm not going to make any restriction, only that it is in steady state, the star rotates in steady state, and that the rotation law does not depend on the azimuthal angle. And one has to be careful to apply the momentum equation also to the stellar matter that is rotating. I will first tell you briefly about the numerical results of Moreno and Certis-Tal when they found that the geometrical asymmetry can result from the nonlinear evolution of the rising flux tubes. They took as initial condition a flux tube that is in mechanical, that is to say in force equilibrium. And that there is force equilibrium means that the binormal component yields that inner density equal outer density. So there is no buoyancy in equilibrium. While the normal component of the momentum equation yields a relationship between the angular velocity inside the tube and the angular velocity outside the tube at the place where the tube is in mechanical equilibrium. So that a non-buoyant flux tube in equilibrium must have an internal angular velocity related to the external angular velocity by this simple relationship. And this means, by applying the ideal gas law, that the inside of the flux tube must be slightly cooler, slightly, say, a couple of degrees cooler than the surrounding medium. How such an equilibrium can be attained, this we suggested in 92. I don't want to go now into the details of this. Because then you cannot have, if the rotation inside is the same as the rotation outside, then you do not have that the normal component of the momentum equation yields equilibrium. If you want to have equilibrium, mechanical equilibrium, you must have this relationship between the internal and the external angular velocities. Sorry?
What is the relation to this?
what is the orientation? Did you only read something like this? You have consider a plane. It needn't be. Omega is a vector pointing upwards. So the matter in the flux tube rotates with a given angular velocity, and the matter outside rotates with a different angular velocity. And this comes from the fact that, in general, the flux tube that is somewhere in mechanical equilibrium can have been formed somewhere else. But by angular momentum conservation, if it moves, trying to attain at each time mechanical equilibrium, this is what I'm representing. Well, I have a bigger plot. It's the same here. Well, imagine the tube is beginning to be formed here by differential rotation. The magnetic flux, the magnetic field strength is being amplified here. Then it becomes too buoyant, so it has to rise. But because rising means going away from the axis of rotation, this goes against angular momentum conservation. So the flux tube will oscillate about an equilibrium, about the axis of rotation, position that does not differ from the axis of rotation, until it reaches a place where it is no longer buoyant. And consider that moving to higher latitudes parallel to the axis of rotation means going outwards. No, if you don't know, but in order to have the flux tube in equilibrium, in mechanical equilibrium, then binormal component of the equation of motion requires that inside density equal outside density. In general, yes. Well, there is a competition between curvature force, the Coriolis force, due to the fact that the inside of the flux tube is rotating with a different angular velocity than the outside. This amounts to having a longitudinal flow inside the flux tube. Well, no, but you can avoid buoyancy simply by pushing the flux tube outwards. Pushing it outwards, it cannot simply go radially outwards because of angular momentum conservation. So going outwards means moving to high latitudes parallel to the axis of rotation. So the final position here,
another way to say straight line.
The Coriolis force balances the tension force. I'm going to address this problem later, this exactly as you have formulated it with the rubber band on a greasy surface. So that there is this constraint in the angular velocity is simply a requirement of having force equilibrium between the flux tube and the outside. And taking as initial condition a toroidal flux tube at the bottom of the convection zone, or in the overshoot layer, that becomes unstable to small perturbations. Moreno and Surtees et al. Found that the tube rises across the convection zone in about 30 days. I think this is generally accepted nowadays, until it reaches the photosphere. They found that the follower wing of the loop, this is the preceding because this is the direction of rotation, the follower wing is always more inclined to the horizontal than the preceding wing. And the interesting point is that the follower side is more inclined at all levels in the convection zone. So at all levels in the convection zone, the tube shows exactly the kind of asymmetry that is required to explain the observations of Andriel and Petrovai. The maximum inclination between the P wing and the F wing is attained somewhere in the middle of the convection zone. So these authors concluded that the geometrical asymmetry of the active regions is due to the nonlinear rise through the convection zone. And now, the point I want to bring here to your attention is the following. Is the asymmetry itself the consequence of this nonlinear rise through the convection zone? Or is the asymmetry already there at the very instant when an instability sets in? What I think is that the asymmetry is not the consequence of the nonlinear rise. The asymmetry is the consequence of an instability, buoyancy instability setting in. So from the early stages of the evolution, the asymmetry is already there and it has the right shape. In order to do that, I have performed a linear perturbation analysis following practically the steps of a pioneer paper by Henk and von Vallehoyen in 81 or 82. Consider the Lagrangian perturbations about the original path of the flux tube. This gives us the path of the tube when it is unperturbed. We introduce a Lagrangian perturbation where the radial, the space coordinate is the unperturbed path length. So this we use as Lagrangian coordinate. I will denote with zero all equilibrium values. For instance, omega e zero is the angular velocity of the stellar matter outside the flux tube, but close to the flux tube. And we perform a normal mode analysis, so that partial derivatives with respect to t at constant Lagrangian derivative is multiplication by I omega. And instead of using S naught, I can equivalently use the arc length, instead of the arc length, the corresponding angular value in the unperturbed path of the flux tube. So taking this derivative is equivalent to multiplying with I m. And after a lot of calculations, one arrives at the dispersion relation, which is a sixth order polynomial in which the fifth order term does not appear. Now, these coefficients are all real. We don't have any dissipation. And they are determined by the coordinates, the position of the flux tube in equilibrium. They depend on the value of the magnetic field, on the value of the angular velocity at this point, on the gradient of this angular velocity, and on the physical parameters that we get from a stellar interior model for this position. So when Henk did this work many years ago, he took the convection overshoot. Yeah, you put a subadiabatic polytropic model at the bottom of the convection zone. I have used, always when I give numerical values, I have used a convection zone model calculated by Michael Stix in Freiburg, and he uses a non-local mixing length theory so that the overshoot layer below the convection zone automatically comes out of these calculations. Now, what I want to do is to show analytically how the Coriolis force is responsible for creating this asymmetry even in the linear regime. So in order that I can proceed working analytically, I have to do some restrictions. And the main restriction is assume that we are considering a flux tube at the equator. Of course, at the equator, we will not have any tilt angle, but I'm not trying to explain the tilt. I'm trying to explain the asymmetric shape of the loop. Otherwise, I cannot proceed analytically. I would have to be solving now a sixth order polynomial equation. If I work at the equator, it turns out that the perturbations perpendicular to the equatorial plane decouple from the perturbations contained within the equatorial plane. So the sixth order dispersion relation splits into a second order one and a fourth order one. Perturbations perpendicular to the equatorial plane can only give rise to instabilities if we consider the mode m equals zero. This is what George mentioned before. It is as if we had a rubber band on a polished or greasy sphere. If we move it a little upwards, it will become unstable and evolve toward the poles. This is the only mode that can become unstable for perturbations perpendicular to the equatorial plane. For perturbations contained within the equatorial plane, we can have both stable or unstable modes, depending on the different parameter values we put into the dispersion relation. M equals zero would mean a flux tube that either contracts or expands. M equals one would mean a rigid motion of the flux tube in one direction without changing its shape. M equal two would be squeezing it so that we produce two humps. And M equal three with three humps, and so on. It's clear that if we want to study the asymmetry, M equals zero is not interesting for that. It will not create any asymmetry. So an asymmetry can only come from a linear superposition of unstable modes with M equal one or larger than one. So we are doing a normal mode analysis. So we consider Fourier components of the Lagrangian perturbation in this form. This is the complex amplitude. And with the help of the linearized equations, we find out that the relationship between the azimuthal component of the amplitude and the radial component of the amplitude is given by this expression, in which omega I is the inertial frequency. This is omega A is the Alfvén frequency, Alfvén speed multiplied with the wave number. And this combination of terms, I do not know whether it has a physical meaning. I have simply called it omega H because it has the dimensions of the frequency. It is always less than zero for the bottom of the convection zone. But we will see later it does not play any role whether it is less or the sign of omega H will not play any role. In general, the solutions of the dispersion relation are complex. So let us separate the real part, the imaginary part. And then the relationship between the amplitude of the perturbations in the azimuthal direction is related to the amplitude of the perturbations in the radial direction by an expression like this, in which I have simply separated real and imaginary part. So the real part is this expression, and it only contains the frequency itself in the form of sigma, imaginary part, eta, real part, and these frequencies that I have introduced above. So even if the formulae get more complicated, they will only contain these three things. And Q is the imaginary part that in the future will not play any role anymore. So the first impression I got when I began doing this analytical calculation is that there is no asymmetry in the linear regime. And the reason is that if we take the real part of the, I'm not putting the, this hat anymore, the amplitude, clear that it means the amplitude of the perturbation, the real part of the amplitude of the perturbation in a thermophile direction can be written as a constant. We have one constant, one amplitude that cannot be determined because we are doing a linear analysis. This is an exponential, and then it is the combination of a sinus and a cosinus. And if we sum sinus and a cosinus, we are not getting any asymmetry. So the first thought is there is no asymmetry in the linear regime. But now, this is in the Lagrangian description. And when we when we say that a flux tube prior to eruption will look like that, we are implicitly considering the Eulerian description, because we define the P spot as the intersection of this wing of the rising flux tube with the surface. And this is the other cut with the surface. So we have to go now to the Eulerian description if we want to find an asymmetry. We cannot do that in the Lagrangian description. So if xi is the displacement vector as a function of the Lagrangian coordinate, then call capital X the same displacement, but as a function of the Eulerian coordinate. Phi is the angle along around the flux tube. Then when we turn this expression for the real part of the amplitude of the perturbation in phi, when we turn this from the Lagrangian description into the Eulerian description, from going to here, we have to do a little bit of differential geometry of plane curve. It's quite straightforward. Then we get this expression for the asymmetry. But now this is an implicit equation, because we have here x phi and we have here x phi. And in principle, we cannot solve for this, but we are doing a linear analysis. If we are doing a linear analysis, I can expand. I can make an expansion taking into account that the deviation of the path of the flux tube in a linear perturbation will be very small compared with the distance of the flux tube from the center of the sun. So up to first order in the perturbations, that is implicitly what we have been doing from the very moment we began linearizing the equations, we have that the real part of the vector displacement in the radial direction has this structure. We are not interested in how complicated the coefficients are. They're quite complicated if we go back to the original dispersion relation. We have the sum of a cosinus, sinus squared, and sinus times cosinus. So if we have an asymmetry, this asymmetry in the linear regime must come from here. So if we identify this coefficient, it is proportional to P, to the real part of that formula I showed before, the real part of this expression. This expression only contains the frequency and these three other frequencies that I have defined. So these three frequencies are going to determine whether this coefficient P, or this term, will be less than zero, larger than zero, or zero. So here is again the expression, this coefficient P. Assume we have no rotation. Now don't care whether the flux tube is stable or unstable. We do not have rotation, as in the first paper of Henk and Van Balleghoyen on this topic. If we have no rotation, this means that the eigenvalues are either real, called pure imaginary. That is to say, we have either real part or imaginary part. So this P is zero, because either sigma is zero or the other eta is zero. So without rotation, we do not get an asymmetric loop, even if it is unstable. Now assume we have rotation, but the flux tube is oscillating about its equilibrium position. In this case, sigma is also zero. Sigma is the imaginary part. If it's stable, sigma must be zero, otherwise we would have a perturbation that is growing exponentially. And if sigma is zero, it vanishes here and it vanishes here. So we do not have, when the flux tube is oscillating about its equilibrium position, we do not have any asymmetry. Sigma is the imaginary part of the relationship between the amplitude. Yes, but if one is negative, the other is positive. Because we have the solutions in form of complex conjugate. So with rotation, without rotation, we do not have asymmetry. With rotation, but without instability, we do not have the asymmetry. So we have to study now the case of instability and rotation. And I'm going to do this within the framework of the magnetostrophic approximation. As far as I know, the magnetostrophic approximation was introduced into this business of flux tubes also by Henk. I don't know whether you used this name or not. I think you used the name case of fast quasi-rigid rotation. I think this is the terminology you used, but it amounts to assuming the magnetostrophic approximation. The magnetostrophic approximation is a generalization to MHD from the geostrophic approximation in geophysical fluid dynamics. This is in the geostrophic. You have geostrophic regime in atmospheric flows, for instance, when the horizontal component of the gradient of force, of pressure, is compensated with the horizontal component of the Coriolis force. And in the you cannot do any weather prediction with this very simple assumption, but the winds at any given time, winds in the atmosphere, do not differ by more than 10-15% from the geostrophic wind you would have for a given distribution of pressure. So this is it's a first approximation, a rough approximation to the wind distribution at a given time, but it does not give you any possibility of doing weather prediction. Yeah. In the magnetostrophic approximation, then replace the gradient of pressure by the Lorentz force. We are doing the same. Now, how can we apply the magnetostrophic approximation to the solar case or to a rotating star? We can apply it when we have either weak magnetic fields or we have a rapid rotation. It is when we write the equation of motion in dimensionless form, one thing is equivalent to the other. Now, are we in the Sun in the position of saying that the flux tubes that are going to erupt or are going to become unstable to erupt are weak? Well, below some 60, 70,000 Gauss, the magnetostrophic approximation yields very good results. I have tested this simply comparing the results from this approximation from the general general solution. I will show you the quantitative criterium is that the inertial frequency squared is much larger than the Alfven frequency squared. This is twice. So this is four times, this is squared, this is four times the rotation. So if this applies, we can use the magnetostrophic approximation. And it turns out that in the magnetostrophic approximation, we can compute exactly the eigenfrequencies. the eigensolutions. Then the real part is given by this product of these three frequencies I defined at the beginning. So this term P, the real part, that gives us whether we have the asymmetry and whether we have the right sign of the asymmetry, the sign is determined by the sign of this. Because only the case sigma larger than zero is of interest, because only in this case we have instability. So the sign of P is determined by the sign of these three terms. But if we are using the magnetostrophic approximation, it turns out that this sum is always less than zero. So the term P is always less than zero. And the P less than zero yields the right asymmetry independently of the m, of the value of m, of the azimuthal wave number that we are considering. So this would be the case for m equal 2. This is the direction of solar rotation. The p wing is less inclined with respect to the horizontal than the f wing. We have the same for m equal 3. We have the same for all values of m. So this means that I think so, yes. I think it gets less pronounced. So in any case, the shape of the flux tube in the linear regime will be a linear superposition corresponding to all these possible values of m. M equals 0 does not contribute to the asymmetry. All the values m equal 1 or larger than 1 that contribute to the asymmetry, they all have the right asymmetry. So when you sum over all possible m's, you get the right asymmetry. This is looking from the north pole, so this is the direction of rotation. I think this can be understood in terms of angular momentum conservation. I don't know if I can give you now a simple picture of it. Not in the linear regime. No, it works in general. Of course, for the general case, I will come to that at the end. I cannot prove that analytically, but I have considered several depths in the overshoot layer, also at the bottom of the convection zone, and I always get the right sign for P. Now, let us see what happens with the roots of the dispersion relation. I don't know if I'm over time now. In the case where we have no rotation, there are four non-axisymmetric modes. I have represented these four modes on this diagram. Here is magnetic field strength, and here is the frequency in dimensionless units. So we have, for sufficiently low field strengths, we have four different modes of oscillation. These two modes are basically these two modes here are basically longitudinal tube waves. And these here have a mixed character between that and Fenn waves. Now when we switch on rotation and consider the magnetostrophic approximation, two modes have the inertial frequency. This one propagates in the direction opposite to solar rotation. This one propagates in the direction of solar rotation. This has simply to do with the choice of signs that I have made in the form of the normal of the Fourier components. And these two modes that are for sufficiently low field strength longitudinal tube waves, for a given field strength, they merge, they become unstable. The instability that gives rise to the asymmetric shape of the flux tube results from the merging of these two modes. Now, this is in the magnetostrophic approximation. What happens if I don't use the magnetostrophic approximation? I think this you had put this question before. Well, if you consider the general case, we still have two modes that vary, at least for sufficiently low field strength. They are practically the inertial, they have the inertial frequency. And these two practically correspond to these longitudinal tube waves. They become unstable for a given field strength. If we continue increasing the field strength, it can happen that one of these longitudinal tube waves that propagate along the flux tube in the direction of solar rotation gets coupled with one of the inertial modes. Actually, the inertial mode propagating in the direction of solar rotation. And they give rise to a different kind of instability. By the way, if we put here values typical for the bottom of the convection zone, it turns out that this instability here has a very long growth time, the order of 1,000 days, while this one here has a very short growth time of the order of weeks, few weeks. It has to do with the coupling between the inertial wave with the longitudinal tube wave. It is about factor 2, yes. This is, well, a little less. This is for about 70,000, the second instability, for a little more than 100,000. But now, from the point when the flux tube has reached this field strength, the asymmetry is already there. So if we are trying to explain where is the origin of the asymmetry already originates here. And if we compare the two plots, up to the point where the first instability that gives rise to the asymmetry in the shape appears, they practically the magnetostrophic approximation coincides with the exact solution. So the magnetostrophic approximation is not appropriate if we want to study the instability that, with a very short growth time, that probably is responsible for expelling the flux tube from the overshoot layer in case we assume the flux tubes are stored there. But if we are focusing on the origin of the asymmetric shape, the origin is here. So the magnetostrophic approximation is, I think, perfectly correct for this case. Well, you do not have the amplitude of the asymmetry because you have a free amplitude. No, the degree of the asymmetry, no. The shape, yes. The sign of this coefficient P is also the same. Of course, this cannot be proved analytically, but this can be simply a matter of solving a fourth order equation. I have considered several depths in the convection zone. Yes. qualitatively, it's the same. Of course not. This, the final shape of the asymmetry depends on the non-linear rise through the convection zone. Qualitatively, not quantitatively. I cannot say how much is at the base because there is a free, there is a free parameter that is the amplitude. I cannot tell you how much is the amplitude because I'm doing a linear stability analysis. That is the point. There is always one constant factor. Well, the shape, I don't know if we are talking about the same. The fact that this, the F spot, or the F wing, is more vertical than that, you always have this. It depends on M. In general, the real path, the actual path, is a linear superposition of all values of M. Okay. I don't know the. The most unstable for real conditions at the bottom of the convection zone is m equal 1 or m equal 2. This I can tell you. M equal 1 or m equal 2. So the depths in the, yes, but fine, after the non-linear evolution through the whole convection zone, you can no longer speak of m equal 1 or m equal 2. You can only speak about that at the very early stages of the evolution. Well, the shape you have there from the beginning. I don't understand what you mean by how much. Yes. Okay, you mean the position of the maximum with respect to the earth. Yes. I will have to look at that. What do you mean by local? M equal 100, for instance. Well, when you have the flux tube in equilibrium and you perturb it, perturbations that have a very short wavelength are not unstable because the tension force.
Yeah.
the higher modes are not unstable. For all real conditions we have considered, initially only m equal 1 or m equal 2 play a role. Even if you place the flux tube outside the overshoot layer, at the bottom of the convection zone, you do not get... Of course, this is assuming that you have an initial equilibrium that is axisymmetric. Yeah. But in any case, the point I want to make here is whether the asymmetry that was reported on these numerical, after these numerical simulations, whether this is really a consequence of nonlinear rise, or you can get this from the very beginning. The question is, I think you can get it from the very beginning, but from the very beginning when the asymmetry sets in and not when the flux tube is oscillating about its equilibrium position. It could have been that the asymmetry in the linear regime has the opposite sign, or that it depends on the field strength or on other values, but regardless which values you use, which ambient values you use for pressure, density, and so on, which is the field strength, you always get the right shape of the asymmetry, regardless which is the m that you are considering. And for the case one wants to use the full dispersion relation, I have computed it for several depths. One is at the bottom of the convection zone. One is in the middle of the overshoot layer, close to the radiative zone. One is in the middle of the overshoot layer. Actually, the numerical simulations of Moreno and Certisdal started from a flux tube that originally lies 2,000 kilometers below the top of the overshoot layer. So I have scanned the overshoot layer, the lower part of the convection zone, according to the convection zone model of Stieg's. If you use a non-local mixing length theory, you already have at the bottom of the convection zone, you have a layer that is sub-adiabatic, so it would help. At the bottom, yeah. And one value corresponds to the part of the convection zone where delta, the sub-adiabaticity, is already positive. For all these cases, it turns out that the asymmetry, in the general case, I mean, without doing the assumption of magnetostrophic approximation, the asymmetry also has the right shape. So my conclusion is that the asymmetry already exists there from the very beginning. Of course, one can ask, would it also happen outside the equatorial plane? Well, in this case, this cannot be done analytically, as far as I know. Yeah, but when I don't think that you can say that so easily. When you are outside the equatorial plane, you have many types of instabilities. If you look at the bifurcation diagram like this, when you are outside the equatorial plane, you can have many different types of instabilities. Well, the equator, yes, it is a unique place, and it is the place where you switch off the tilt. So you have only one geometrical asymmetry. That's why probably you can do that analytically. Point
important. I mean, you have an equilibrium state, right? And then also important.
Yeah.
And you preserve, you get the linearized stress of this equation, which therefore are also not dependent on you. Then you would expect that the eigenfunction stays in the soil. But you get an eigenfunction which is also
but you, I don't think this has to do with linearity or non-linearity. You can. Yeah, but that was for a continuum. Sorry for. I didn't understand the message. Well, yes, but the asymmetry is something we see in the Lagrangian picture. What do you conclude from this? Yes, in the continuous field distribution, for instance, you need to give the vertical gradient of the magnetic field. That makes things much more difficult too. You needn't take in the huge dispersion relation of the paper by Acheson, everywhere appears the vertical derivative of the magnetic field. Difficult to say because you cannot use for the initial condition this relationship probably between the inside and the outside velocity.
No, I'm saying, okay, there's probably one argument for four more rounds. Okay. So if one gets two rounds, it's a half inch turn. Three rounds, it's a third inch turn. So if you get one third inch, it's one third inch, it's a third inch.
This is a very, very convenient initial condition, actually.